Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. What's the hungriest you've ever been? What's the most you've eaten at one time? And are you a fan of competitive eating? I am. My name's Ben.
My name's Noah. I'd say probably maybe a Korean barbecue situation or an old school buffet where you really feel compelled to get the bang for your buck. You know, you've paid an amount. Korean barbecue especially, because they just keep on bringing it. And there's all the little banchans, which I know you like, the little sides. So That's a recipe for gluttony there.
You're Noel.
That is who I am.
Yeah,
it's true.
Yeah.
Thank you for reminding me and the listeners. That would have been a real bone of contention if we had moved forward without saying each other's names, in addition to super producer Casey Pegram.
That's right. Casey, what's the... You don't strike me as a particularly gluttonous dude. None of the three of us are. I'm probably the closest. But do you recall ever... eating so much that you felt like terrible about it?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I've been in those situations a few times. Nothing, not like a competitive eating sort of, practicing on my own, you know, getting ready for the big day.
That's right. What, like maybe a family holiday situation or something?
Exactly. But I have had that experience of paying for an extremely expensive buffet and then feeling like, I got to get my money's worth. Did that recently in Vegas, actually.
I knew it. The old Vegas buffet.
Yeah, and it's like we waited like probably close to 2 hours to get up to the line, and only then did they tell us it's like $100 a head or whatever. And it's just like, well, we're going to be eating a lot of crab legs and, you know, just trying to maximize our value.
It's insane. I've seen people get a ticket for a Vegas buffet and go in at 11 and then literally hang out on the premises long enough to just use the bathroom and get hungry again.
That's pretty much what you got to do. But we made the best of it.
Is there a prime rib station?
No, actually, I was disappointed. There was not much in the way of steak.
Ah.
But there were other kind of fancy seafood-based things.
Okay. And, $100 a head, I would expect rib.
Yes. I was expecting like filet mignon or something. But... you know, they did have enough. I don't know if we actually covered our outlay for that, but you know, it was a good buffet anyway.
Yeah, you know, it's weird because the way that Vegas buffets are priced, they are making a ton of money off most people, because most people are going to eat maybe a plate or two and then say, "Well, I want to go do the Vegas stuff, right? I want to see a show, go to a casino, or drive to the Hoover Dam." I've been fascinated by competitive eating for a long time. As a participant, not so much. As an observer, love it. Kobayashi, Sonia the Black Widow Thomas, any number of people. One thing that's interesting about eating and what makes us full is there's a thing called the, I think it's called the satiety response. Have you heard of this?
Yeah. It does have something to do with like you got to trick your body into not telling your brain that it's full. And that's a big principle of competitive eating, right?
Yeah. That's why so much of it is timed. So years ago on a YouTube show I was doing that I will, I think you've seen it, Casey, but I'm not going to share it with anyone. I did an experiment with the satiety complex, and essentially it means it takes your stomach about 17 to 23 minutes to tell your brain it's full. So you can eat like a god or a demon or just a swirling vortex or black hole for up to that amount of time often before your body goes, "Whoa, Buster. Some of this is going back out."
Right. And that's the thing. I mean, you know, you think about Greek bacchanalian feasts and all of the vomitoriums and all of that stuff. Is that real? I mean, is that actually something that you can do to just continue indulging?
People have done it, but that is not healthy for you. You know, that's not... There's a reason we haven't evolved to eat that way, because ultimately it can... it can damage your system, you know. Food can be a tough thing. It's strange too, because the more we learn about science, the more we're learning about things we usually just took for granted, or even in some cases treated like, I know this is going to be a controversial word for some of us, treated like a freak show territory. And that's where we get to today's story.
Yeah, it's true. Today's story is about a gentleman by the name of, Casey helped us with this earlier. I think I'm going to do my level best. Tahar?
Tahar.
Tahar.
Yeah, you got it.
Casey on the case.
Casey on the case indeed. Which is apparently, it's thought to be a nickname that came from a very popular French phrase, which I adore, boom, boom, ta-ra, which means it's sort of like boom goes the dynamite. I think that's literally what it means, used to describe fireworks or explosives. This gentleman, who we only know by ta-ra, was born in 1772 in Lyon, and by the time he was 17, despite reportedly being able to consume a quarter cow's worth of beef in a single day, he only weighed 100 pounds, which is something that's always fascinated me about the world of competitive eating, Ben. Often the folks that excel at it the best are pretty slim.
Yeah, it's true. There was a rumor for a long time that Takeru Kobayashi, one of the very slender competitive eating champions, was actually somehow mutated, and that his stomach could expand beneath his rib cage.
Okay,
so for more storage space. That was never confirmed, as far as I know. But if you think about it, the bigger dudes are also, their stomach has less room to expand because there's more muscle and stuff around
right? Yeah. But the thing about Tara is he went beyond, well beyond, just consuming beef in copious amounts. He had a penchant for eating just about anything. And we'll get to it in a second, but this is actually a condition, a very rare condition known as polyphagia, which is characterized by insatiable hunger, uncontrollable eating, and also, again, as pointed to by his slender build, a very, very high metabolism. So he parlayed this into a career with a traveling freak show.
Yeah, he had a rough, rough life. He was kicked out of home as a teenager, and according to a couple of reports, he traveled around France, became a bit of a vagabond, and at first he was traveling with bandits and sex workers, and then later he became sort of a warm-up act to another traveling show where he would swallow stuff. He was like that kid you hear about in preschool or elementary school who's eating, you know, glue or something for a dollar or whatever the going rate for glue eating is now. I don't know. Let us know.
Right? What was it back in your glue eating days, Ben?
I never ate glue. No. What about you? What was it in your day?
I more sniffed glue, but I never
ate it. Do people pay for that?
No, they don't. But
that was a passion project.
It was a passion project. I'm kidding. I didn't do that. But Ben, I only ask you about the eating glue thing is because you came clean on this here very show about your goldfish eating day. So I assume maybe you had other experimental eating periods.
Polyphagia, right?
Indeed.
Yeah, no, not that much. But I even in my wild days, I had nothing on nothing on Tarad.
Oh, gosh. No, none. Few would or could or absolutely should.
Yeah, he would, when he was doing the traveling show, as he's evolving toward this, you know, this kind of freak show thing mentioned earlier, he would eat corks, stones, live animals. One time he ate a whole basket of apples, which I think, whether or not that's impressive depends on the size of the basket, doesn't it? Because there could be a tiny basket, and there could be a gigantic, like, bushel load basket.
Did he eat the basket as well as the apples is my question.
Right. I think in that case, he just ate the apples. But what a big finish to eat the basket. He also was, physically, he had some unique characteristics, right? Like, his lips are described in messyandchic.com. with this great title, Whatever You Do, Don't Tell the French About Tarad. They say that he had almost non-existent lips, and he had a really wide kind of frog-like mouth. This I had a hard time believing. His mouth could hold 12 eggs at once. Are they chicken eggs? Again, it's like the basket. Is it a quail egg? I can believe that.
Yeah, I mean, I can only assume that they mean quail eggs, but he also had another particularly stomach-turning feature. That's a pun. I'm also preparing listeners. This is pretty gross. His you used the word deflated, Ben, his deflated stomach sack hung loose in such a fashion that he could actually wrap it around his body like a belt.
Yeah, picture that for a minute. So you know how we're talking about this off air, probably the closest analog I could draw is if someone has been exercising or for one reason or another, they lose a lot. They're a very big person. They lose a lot of weight very quickly. Your skin is just another organ, right? And so it can still hang down or deflate because there's less stuff under it than there used to be. And for Tarar, from what we can tell, it seems like he had been routinely eating so much stuff to such an extreme that his stomach, the flesh over his stomach, had kind of naturally over time grown or expanded, so that like you said, Noel, when he's not eating, it's kind of like an empty sack, you know?
Yep. Yeah, and extreme polyphagia is super, super rare, almost to the point where, isn't it kind of almost like looked on with a little bit of suspicion? Like, is it really a real thing?
For some time, it had been considered anecdotal.
Yeah.
But there's some science we can get into maybe toward the end, because science does have an answer. And we have to tell you the story about Tarar, because it's a story, spoiler alert, that you may be able to see in the modern world, as insane as it sounds.
Sure, sure. So we'll definitely get to that science, but it is characterized, the concept of it, as someone just not being able to control their appetite at all. And the extra kind of disturbing feature is that it typically involves eating non-food items.
Yeah, it's similar, but it's not like pica, it's called, you know, when people eat clay, which is a thing that happened here in the American South, because it's unrelenting. It's an insatiable hunger. It's kind of like a real life version of the myth of Tantalus, you know, Tantalus, who is up to his chin in delicious liquids, and then he's got grapes so close to his face, and every time he tries to grab a grape or a fruit or whatever, and every time he tries to take a sip, it vanishes. It feels like it goes beyond a medical condition to some sort of biblical curse.
Really?
You'll eat and never be full.
And that's exactly the case, and a big bone of contention within his household when he was a kid. His parents had become so frustrated with their inability to satiate him, and it was honestly a financial burden. He would cry and cry and cry even when he had just completed a massive meal. They finally kicked him out of his house, and that is when he kind of began that life as sort of a nomad traveler, and leagued up with everyone from sex workers to the thieves that you mentioned, and then eventually found his way into sort of the carnival lifestyle, where he was taken in and welcomed. He became a street performer in Paris on the Pont Neuf, and that was an area that was considered so disreputable and seedy that even known philanderer Benjamin Franklin found it too sketchy to walk across it. It's a bridge in Paris.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And this is not a super correct term nowadays, but what he was doing, his act was pretty much, it was a predecessor to the famous, you know, circus geek acts of yesteryear when someone would eat a live chicken, but he didn't just eat live chickens. And we have firsthand accounts of Tarar's act. Here's a quote, and I warn you, this is not super appetizing. He seized a live cat with his teeth, eventrated, that's the word for disemboweled, eventrated it, sucked its blood, and ate it, leaving the bare skeleton only. He also ate dogs in the same manner. On one occasion, it was said that he swallowed a living eel without chewing it. That's disgusting.
Yeah. Is that part of the show, or that stuff he just did in his own private alone times?
No, this was part of the show.
Jeez Louise.
So that's why whenever you see a street show and someone says, who has a pet in the audience?
Ooh,
just make for the hills.
Definitely, definitely don't offer up your little, your shih tzu. That is really disturbing. And absolutely barbaric, and I can't believe people were into this. I would think, you know, that would have caused people to just, you know, turn in disgust. But I guess people's appetites were pretty disgusting back in those days.
And they had a different, less sanitized idea of entertainment. If you were the kind of person who would watch this guy eat random stuff, if that was the way you wanted to spend your afternoon, you would have to be prepared for the smell, the aroma, the stench. Because although Torad was a, you know, average-sized dude and pretty much on the skinny side, he had a big smell. He had big smell energy. We found something in the London Medical and Physical Journal in 1819 describing his smell. Noel, since I did the eating the cat thing, do you want to handle the stench part?
Yeah, okay. I will just preface by saying that this stench followed him around his whole life. It was something that was reported as early as when he was 17 and would sneak into town to eat the cow's feed. And he, you know, again, had that slender build, but always was followed around by this putrid stench. So here is that quote from the London Medical and Physical Journal from 1819. Quote, I'm going to try my best to get through this. Terrar was constantly covered in sweat, and from his body a vapor arose, sensible to the sight, and more so the smell. So wait, like stink lines?
Like pig pen, yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. And more so to the smell. He had a wispy blonde hair and a large mouth surrounded by slender lips and discolored teeth. He frequently burped and farted and had constant, particularly odorous Ben, why would you do this to me? Odorous bowel movements.
I had to
you're right.
Talk about the cat.
I can't tell which one's worse. I think you're right, Ben. I think maybe the cat was worse.
But so, Casey, can we get some sound effects of burps and farts? Just real quick.
Or maybe it is one of those, like, the ship sounds, or like from Ren and Stimpy, when one of those smelly-looking close-ups.
A little okay. High-pressure fart at the end.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Exactly. Ugh. Odorous bowel movements. That was my favorite member of the band Gore, which one would expect from someone whose diet consisted of massive amounts of both food and non-food items. All right, first of all, I want to know what one would expect from the smell of someone who ate non-food items.
Depends on the food items. You know, right. If they're just swallowing rocks, they'll probably pebbles, they'll probably just pass through and maybe yeah. not make a big smell. But if it's organic non-food items, I would imagine at some point it also interacts with your microbiome, mm-hmm. your gut flora, so you can get some pretty disgusting stuff. Today I would have been set to be a street for performer, you know, and keep in mind there is a history in France of very successful performers doing things that might be disgusting to us, like professional farters, flatulists. What was that guy's name? Le Petitman.
Le Petitman.
So this is not an unusual thing in the history of performance in France. And could Terrar have made a living doing this? Yeah, probably. But something intervened. As you said, he was born in what, 1772? In 1789, France was racked by the French Revolution. And so Terrar joined the French military. He didn't fight. He helped people out with day-to-day tasks. And then when he would help them, they would give him their rations and he would eat them. And eventually he ended up in the military hospital because no matter what he ate, he was still hungry. And the physicians wanted to see how far they could go. So they quadrupled his rations. He ate those. He was still hungry. He also ate gauze that was intended, you know, to patch up soldiers. And he ate any live animals he could find. And then one time, true story, they found him in a gutter during his time at the hospital, shoving fistfuls of literal garbage into his mouth. I want to also note, I don't think we hit this yet. We have multiple accounts of people saying, yeah, other than the eating and the disgusting smell, he was a normal dude, but he was also super apathetic. Like, he didn't seem very present a lot of times. He was just sort of like, I don't know, whatever, I'll eat it. And I think that I'm building a case toward what I think may have been a lower mental function. Like, I think maybe he wasn't a full set of crayons.
Oh, no. Oh, I don't think so either. Yeah. I mean, definitely seemed to go hand in hand. And it's also part of the reason why I question the medical veracity of this quote-unquote condition. It seems like it was largely a mental condition. Now, not that that makes anything any less real. I mean, psychological sure. conditions are absolutely all-consuming for people, and they can really cause huge problems in people's quality of life and the way they interact with others. But I don't know that there's necessarily a physical or physiological thing that caused him to feel this way, other than maybe something that was going on psychologically. It reminds me of a condition that's depicted in the show Better Call Saul, where Saul Goodman's brother has this allergy to electricity. But that's largely considered by the medical community to not be a real thing.
Yeah, the EMF sensitivity,
that's
right?
That's right. Yeah. So you're right. I mean, in the military, he was super problematic. But he also – there were some creative uses for him, right?
There were attempts. There were attempts to make him useful. So the weird thing is he also wasn't gaining weight, by the way. He still weighed, I think you mentioned earlier, 100 pounds back when he was 17. He still had that ballpark weight, and he was exhibiting signs of undernourishment, as a matter of fact. So they thought, all right, we're gonna try to make this guy useful because he has something. It's not perfect, but he's got potential. He's got an unusual set of skills.
That's right. That's right. Might as well figure out how to make some use out of the guy. You got to hang around with the smelly dude. Let's figure out how to take his gift, let's say, and put it to good militaristic use.
Yep. And this is when I'm going to muddle through this, Casey. I hope we're still friends at the end. This is when General Alexandre de Beauharnais said, you know what? No man left behind. We can give this kid something to do. France is now at war with Prussia, and Terrar's weird digestive condition makes him the perfect spy. So he says, all right, I'm putting some documents inside this wooden box. Terrar, you're hungry, right? Go ahead and eat this, and then we'll just wait for it to pass through your body, and then we'll have, you know, whichever soldier is in the most trouble that day go through his stool and then fish the box out to see if you can still read the message. This experiment worked, and so Terrar is given his first mission as a spy.
Yes, indeed. It was a noble experiment, I suppose you could say. One that wouldn't ultimately be repeated, but he was disguised as a Prussian peasant and asked to sneak by enemy lines to deliver a top-secret message to a captured colonel, a French colonel. The message was to be enclosed in a box that was then swallowed whole by Terrar. But unfortunately, he didn't really make it to his destination because of the aforementioned putrid smell. Did not lend itself to covert ops, did it, Ben?
Yeah, that's correct. It's a good point. If you are a spy, you don't want to have a unique sort of olfactory tone, let's call it. I'm searching for diplomatic ways to use the word stink. Yeah, so they find him. He is strip searched. They whip him. They torture him for most of a day. And then eventually he says, okay, I'm here to take a secret message. You know, I'm sneaking it in my gut, and then people are going to find it in my poop. It's about the war. So the Prussians literally chain him to a toilet. And they just wait.
Oh, God.
For hours and hours. And he still stinks, by the way.
Of course he does.
And Terrar is, of course, starving. He has to wait until he has a bowel movement. Eventually, he does void the wooden case. And he tries. This is very gross. This is according to the London Journal. After he couldn't hold it anymore and he passed the case, he swallowed it again to try to keep the enemy from getting it. They finally do get the box out of him, and all they find inside is evidence that this is a test run. The note in the little box just says, hey, let us know if this guy Terrar delivered the box. And it turns out the general still, you know, didn't really trust the guide or this process enough. He needed some confirmed success in the field.
Yeah, well, okay. Good on him then, because this whole thing sounded like a real recipe for disaster, if you ask me, and sure enough it was. God, can you imagine, though, like swallowing it back down and the whole scenario? It's just like, ugh, it's like Reservoir Dogs gone awry or something, you know, like chained to the toilet. I mean, I'm surprised no one's made some kind of sick version of this movie, like a Human Centipede style or something. You know, this should exist. I don't know if I want to see it, but I would support its existence as a piece of schlock cinema. What do you think, Casey?
Yeah, this is ripe for some schlocky goodness.
Did you say ripe?
Yeah.
Oof. Nice. Oof. Yeah, that's the thing. The smell is a main character in this story. Maybe that's what's holding people back. It's just the film technology.
It could be a spiritual predecessor to the big rock movie that did so well this year. Her Smell, it can be called His Smell.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just a thought.
Maybe people feel like they got tricked, though.
I think you're right.
Oh, man, I was looking up so many different synonyms for smell, stink, stench, that kind of stuff, just to get through this. Anyhow.
I'm a big fan of miasma myself, which I guess is a little bit refers to more of like a big picture smell, something that, proliferates a bit farther. But I could categorize what he had as a miasma, since you could actually see the thing.
Yeah, it also had a miasma was for a time a medical explanation for the spread of disease.
That's right.
Which is very believable.
We talked about that in the episode about the great stink of London.
Mm-hmm. So stinking, you know, of course, there's fetid.
Ooh.
Somebody smells fetid, right?
That's bad.
There's also, of course, spoiled or spoiling. And I was trying to find a particular word for that stench, that sulfurous stench of rotten eggs. You guys know what I'm talking about?
Of course.
Yeah, I didn't find one. Oh, and there's also funk, reek, fustiness, malodorousness.
Oh, yeah.
Odoriferousness, which is kind of fun, and rancidity. Yeah, it's rough. But anyhow, these are all just different words to describe what was happening. The Prussian general, by the way, is severely PO'd at Terad, and he says, "Hang the guy. Hang him immediately. I can't believe I let that guy go. What was I thinking? A poop spy." But once he had calmed down, he said, "You know, I feel bad because I see this guy. He's obviously, again, starving his whole life, and he is openly sobbing. He's blubbering at the gallows." And so he takes pity on Terai and he says, "Okay, I'm going to, you guys just give him a very thorough spanking, essentially, and go back to the French lines." So he returned, and he was just doing the thing he did earlier. He's just like, you know, running coffee for people.
Yeah, the Prussians essentially just dumped him back near that military hospital behind French lines. And he, you know, made his case to his superiors, which I don't think would have been too difficult to make, that he was not cut out for the spy's life and that he should, you know, not be asked to do any more secret missions. He just wanted to be a regular smelly foot soldier.
Right, exactly. And he had kind of a patron, a guy named Baron Percy, at the hospital. And Percy tried to satiate Terad. He gave him different treatments that were meant to assuage his appetite, and none of them were successful. I think they tried tobacco pills, straight-up vinegar, wine vinegar, and laudanum. And the thing about the laudanum is, I believe, opiates do actually cause constipation.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's where he was going. I don't know.
Maybe, or, you know, I can't imagine that it would have been particularly comfortable to have all this weird crap floating around in your guts and all of the long-term damage, which we'll find out, you know, was the case, that it would have done to his insides. I imagine that the Terad must have been considerable pain a lot of the time. But you don't really see that in the reports. But maybe that was where he was coming from as well, with giving him a little something to ease it.
Yeah, and this takes a morbid turn. We were having fun in a gross way in the beginning of the episode, but not only did these treatments not work, his condition appeared to accelerate. There was no food that was enough. He had gone past eating trash. During one episode, he was actually caught drinking blood that had been drawn from other patients in the hospital and even noshing on some bodies in the morgue.
I mean, yeah, at this point, it's just becoming sad and really, really, really disturbing. He's almost kind of like taking on this kind of Gollum-like quality where he is just, you know, becoming more and more inhuman. And that is when the disappearance of a 14-month-old baby began to generate rumors that Tarar had somehow gotten a hold of the baby and actually eaten it. I mean, you can't make this stuff up, man. It's And that was at the very hospital that he was admitted to.
That's right. And at this point, it's finally too much for Baron Percy. Tarar has, in his mind, crossed a line. Even if historically we can't 100% confirm this story of the 14-month-old baby disappearing, everybody believed it in the hospital, right? And you can see why. It's not like they just came up with a cockamamie conspiracy theory. So Baron Percy kicks Tarar out the same way that his parents kicked him out when he was a teenager, and he has to fend for himself from then on. He falls off the radar. He's off the grid for like 4 years. And then one day, Baron Percy hears from him again. Tarar has turned up in a hospital in Versailles.
Yeah, and he was at this hospital because he was, in fact, dying. This is something that I would have thought would have happened much sooner, just considering, you know, all of the crazy stuff he put in his body and that he put his digestive tract through. I can't imagine that he was healthy at all. And Baron Percy, who was Baron Percy to him in the first place, Ben?
It's kind of his patron, his benefactor at the hospital.
I see. So he was with him at this point. And he died ultimately, Tarar did, of tuberculosis in 1798 at the young age of 26. And this is probably one of the most nauseating parts of the story, but he was absolutely a fascination and something that medical science could potentially learn something from. So, and of course, just an autopsy is something that happens anyway, but he was cut open, and there are some descriptions of his autopsy that are really, really graphic and just, you know, they really paint a picture of what was going on inside this man's body.
So I guess this one falls to me.
You want to split it?
That's the setup. Let's see how long it goes. All right.
There's two. So yeah. I'll do the second one. Let's go back.
Okay. Yeah. That's equitable.
And this is from allthat'sinteresting.com, these accounts. But this is official, very real accounts of what this autopsy was like.
The entrails were putrefied, confounded together, and immersed in pus. The liver was excessively large, void of consistence, and in a putrescent state. The gallbladder was of considerable magnitude, the stomach in a lax state, and having ulcerated patches dispersed about it, covered almost the whole of the abdominal region.
His stomach, they found, was so massive that it very nearly filled his entire abdominal cavity. His gullet, likewise, was unusually wide, and his jaw could stretch so wide open that, as the reports put it, a cylinder of a foot in circumference could be introduced without touching his palate.
That's insane. And they don't complete this autopsy. Spoiler alert, eventually the smell of the corpse is too much, and they have to stop. They have to throw in the towel. But at this point, they do learn something. They do have a takeaway, and they say, well, he wasn't making this up. Every weird thing he ate, everything he did, was a result of this genuine, constant need to eat. He had been born with a strange body, and as they say in allthat'sinteresting.com, he had been cursed to a life of eternal hunger. And let's bracket this real quick for the science, right? Because you said we're going to follow up on that. Now, as you said, he had polyphagia of some sort. So it turns out it's quite possible that Tarar had something called Prader-Willi syndrome. Have you heard of this? Did we talk about this off air?
No, I don't think so.
It's a genetic disorder wherein some specific genes lose their function And it results in a couple of things. So we can build a case for Prader-Willi because people afflicted with this are constantly hungry. They have mild intellectual impairment, and they will eat tons and tons of stuff. But here's the thing. People with Prader-Willi syndrome tend to grow larger. They become obese, and that never happened to Tarar. He was kind of a stick the whole time, except when he was eating and his stomach inflated.
Right, right. I mean, and then it just snapped back into like a weird gelatinous kind of hanging satchel of skin. Whew.
It's a shame.
It's a shame. The whole thing's a shame. I mean, you know, and I, look, there is some medical research behind this condition. I didn't mean to poo-poo it entirely. I think there's some, you know, controversy behind it, but a guy named Cindy McElroy, who's a doctor based in Huntington, West Virginia, said that there could be more of an underlying condition that is pretty common, actually, just maybe an extreme version, called hyperthyroidism, which increases metabolism and causes diarrhea, sweating, and thin hair. I actually have hypothyroidism, which is an underactive thyroid. This would be an overactive thyroid that would cause your metabolism to just balloon out of control. And that does kind of make sense. So I wonder if that's had something to do with it. Dr. McElroy seems to think so. And it would cause a lot of what Tarar suffered from, some of his symptoms, like diarrhea, sweating, and thin hair.
But he wouldn't eat live animals. People with hyperthyroidism don't automatically snack. They don't have cat snacks.
They do not. They do not. And that's why I tend to think that there's some combination of a mental illness and some kind of undiagnosable at the time physical ailment that sort of perfectly synergize into this bizarre and aberrant condition, you know?
Mm-hmm. And people have studied this guy. Medical historians have contributed quite a bit of literature to him. Jan Bondesen is one of these medical historians, works at the University of Cardiff in Wales. And Dr. Bondesen says we will likely never see anything like Tarar again. Part of it is because medicine has improved so much over the centuries. And, you know, the hope is that if someone with this condition or with this set of problems emerged, they would be diagnosed and treated appropriately, right, instead of being pressed into being some sort of poop spy, a phrase that will haunt me now.
As it should, Ben. As it should haunt us all.
So this is the story of Tarar. And the next time that you are hungry, or the next time that you are, you've eaten too much maybe, and you're satiated, like our good friend and possible prime minister, super producer Casey Pegram, look around the buffet and thank your lucky stars that you are one of the people with the ability to get full.
And hey, Tarar actually lives on in our popular culture and our zeitgeist. He was a pretty popular subject of memes last year. Around August of 2019, there's a piece in New York Magazine called "The Hot New Meme is Tarar," citing a Tumblr that featured quite a few memes referencing Tarar and his supposed consumption of a 14-month-old French baby. So if you want to check that out, you can go to nymag.com/intelligencer/2019/08/tarar-memes-tumblr-squidward.html. I just wanted to read a really long, obnoxious URL.
So I do want to point out this as well, and we'll need to bleep this, so use your imagination. Someone posted on Tumblr, "I know Tarar is the joke of the hour, but it's so incredibly messed up how even now no one has any concrete explanation for what his condition was, and a case like that has not been recorded since. Like, literally, what the f***? He's like a really shitty X-Man." Which is kind of true, you know?
And one of them is from an account by the name of Johnny Joe's Terrible Table. And the caption reads, "When you're a 14-month-old French infant in a military hospital in the late 18th century and that weird hungry guy comes into your room," and it's a picture of Squidward from SpongeBob sitting up in bed with his eyes wide.
Boom, boom, ta-da, indeed, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's a good place to leave it, in the present.
Yes, in the present, and right around lunchtime, oddly enough. Maybe I'll hit up the buffet somewhere. Thank you, as always, to our super producer, Casey Pegram. Thank you to Gabe. Thank you to Christopher. Thank you to Eves.
Huge thanks to research associate Gabe Loser, Jonathan Strickland, the notorious Quister, wherever he may lurk. I hope he's okay. If you want to check us out on social media, you can do so by joining the Ridiculous Historians Facebook group on Facebook. All you got to do is name me or Ben or Casey or some combination of our names or some kind of reference. It lets us know that you're a real person and you are somehow aware of what this podcast is. It's as easy as that. You can also find us on Instagram and Twitter and all of that stuff. If you want to find us individually, you can find me exclusively on Instagram. I am at HowNowNoelBrown.
I also want to point out that you could just get a horrible pun. I've heard some horrible puns recently. Like, no matter how much you push the envelope, it's still stationary. So, yeah. So I would let you in for that.
A bot could never come up with that pun.
Not yet, but we live in the future. And of course, also shout out to Alex Williams, our composer, who also has a podcast of his own that history fans will enjoy called Ephemeral. Check it out while you're on the internet. As Noel said, we are people in our own right. You can follow me on Twitter, where I'm at BenBolinHSW. You can follow me on Instagram, where I am at BenBolin. And oh, Noel.
Yes, sir.
Thanks to you. I think we're both pretty lucky that we can be satisfied with, you know, just a good Sammy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love a good. I know you're. Yeah. Have you made it through your quesadilla phase? Or are you still
squarely? I think I'm back in, man. I just can't quit them. Yeah.
Is it a sandwich, though?
See, this is. You know, it's 2020. Why are we still stuck in labels? I would say it functions as a sandwich.
I would tend to agree with you, Ben. Let us know what you guys think. We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.